Guys in their 20s think about penis enlargement, which is apparently a real thing. I didn't even know that it's an actual surgery. I thought it's like just a bad porn website ad.
They are stretching it and they keep adding some tissue to it. You cannot have too much of an enlargement, so don't expect too much.
How much in percentage?
Maybe.
Does size matter?
I will tell you, if it is less than 2.5 centimeters, it does matter.
You're saying an erect penis less than 2.5?
If it can penetrate 2.5 centimeters inside the vagina, because beyond that, there is no sensation in vagina.
There's a sharp rise in casual dating and dating apps. The amount of STDs they've seen increase lately is insane. How much has it increased?
I see at least 2-3 a week.
Do you think there's many people carrying STDs that don't even know that they have an STD?
Women especially.
Do you get a lot of ball-related problems?
Yeah, we do. Something like torsion of testes. This happens in young men. Even if they are sitting or they are not having any sexual thoughts, they are... testes are like this, that they can just twist.
Is this shaking me up to the realities of being a man in 2024? Welcome to part two of our special conversation with one of the country's top urologists, Dr. Rajesh Taneja. Part one was a blockbuster episode. It was about men's problems related to testosterone, related to penis. Part two is going to be about surgeries that are very specific to men. As you saw in the trailer, this is a very interesting episode. So sit down, I hope alone, but maybe with your family, if you're that kind of a person. Enjoy the episode. It's a fun but extremely knowledgeable conversation with Dr. RT on TRS. Welcome to part two with Dr. Taneja. So, should we begin by directly talking about prostate-based surgeries?
Yes, of course.
That's where we kind of left off in the last one. We'll talk about a lot of other penis-related surgeries as well, robotic surgeries, the future of andrology and urology. That's what this episode is centered around. But I think a good place to begin is prostate-based surgeries because at least in my eyes, I see too many men getting this operation. I'm just wary in terms of the one thing I've learned about both surgery and injury is that it can happen to you. You never know what can happen in life. So I just want that kind of education. How do you actually remove the prostate from someone? What I've understood is there's two situations where a removal of a prostate is required. The first is if there's a cancerous tumor. The second is if the area around the prostate is not elastic enough and therefore the prostate expands inwards and presses your urethra, and then you have problems related to urination. Painful and irritating pissing. So these are the two situations where you'll actually consider going for a surgery. But the prostate produces semen. So if you remove it, what happens to semen production? All this you can go about.
Good. So prostatic diseases would be classified as benign and cancerous.
Sure.
So first talk about benign. So benign prostatic hyperplasia starts in the fourth decade and, you know, histological evidence will be found in most men beyond 40 years. But clinically, 50% of patients will complain something which can be attributed to an enlarged prostate, benign enlargement of prostate. And out of them, maybe 10% would require surgery, which is a very small number. With today's era of the development of pharmacology and the pharmacological agents, the medicines, we can manage a lot of problems related to prostatic enlargement with medication alone and only a very small amount. For example, in my clinic, I get 10 people in a day referred to me for surgery. I refuse to do surgery on 9, do on 1.
Wow.
That is how things are, because a good urologist should be able to find out because I have to answer this question, after the surgery, you will be better than what you are today. And if I can't answer that in affirmation, I shouldn't be operating. So that's very important. So we need to look at a lot of things which may look like prostate enlargement, but they are not. And then you select out patients. So the bottom line is selection of surgery, selection of patient is very important when you are planning surgery for benign prostatic enlargement. So benign prostatic enlargement, when I was a say 1984-85, I was a student, and the professor would put in a finger into the, after opening the abdomen, they would put in a finger and remove the prostate, like they will just pick it up and it would keep bleeding, and I would keep running to the blood bank and get blood, and patient would stay in the hospital for 2 weeks with two tubes inside the abdomen.
Oh my God.
But from there to TURP, which is transurethral resection, so we put in a telescope through the urinary passage and scrape off the obstructing tissue.
As in the penis?
Through the penis.
You put in a
telescope. We go inside the bladder, we go inside and we scrape off the prostate.
1 second, you put in a telescope and your medical devices?
It goes through the telescope sheath. We put in a sheath and then there is everything which is interchangeable through that sheath.
The camera is permanent?
Everything.
The camera is permanent and then you can change
the outer sheath is permanent so that I don't have to rub the tissues. So there is a channel that I have established and then go in and come out and remove the tissues.
So you're not making any cuts on the body?
There are no cuts.
But my point is, aren't you looking at the screen throughout?
Of course, throughout. It is under vision.
The camera is always there and then you put in different devices to go about your surgery.
That's right.
But my point is, you said how there's a tube called the urethra. And then there's the prostate around it. So do you open up the urethra also?
Yes. So because if this is the pipe and I'm going here and this is obstructed, I'll chip off this area. Whatever is obstructing, I'm chipping it off.
Chipping it off?
Yeah. We chip it off with electric current. We have a cutting loop. So we just scrape it, chip it. We keep getting chips. For example, if you were to grate a potato, so there's something that will make slices of potato. There's thin, long slices. So we scrape off the prostate, which is causing obstruction, and open up the passage.
Hold on. I still haven't cleared my full logic surgically. You go in through the tube. You're seeing the camera. Now you are inside that urethra, which is squeezed anyway. So you'll make a cut in the urethra.
Yes.
Then go to the prostate and burn off like the...
Cut it off. Scrape it off.
Okay.
So we see the prostate is causing obstruction.
Right.
So when you go in, you see that things are causing obstruction, that there is no lumen inside. So you cut it, keep chipping it off till you gather a lumen. So you go right up to the capsule of the prostate and remove it.
Got it. And then you seal it up.
No, you don't have to, because then you put in a catheter, a urine bag, and allow the nature to take care so that the bleeding stops and you come back.
Wow.
So this was TURP, transurethral resection of prostate. So when I was a student, I used to think that whenever you make a scrape, there would be a bleeder. There's something that bleeds like a fountain.
Mm.
So you burn that and then it clears off. Then you make next cut, again, there is a bleeder. So I used to wonder, why don't we have a technology where we coagulate the bleeder even before it bleeds? And then my dream came true. In 2004, I started doing lasers. So now we do it with laser, which is virtually a bloodless procedure.
Laser.
So instead of electric current chipping it off, I have a laser fiber and I just take away the tissue. It is like a welding. So you've seen in movies, they will cut the glass with a welder. So similarly, I have a laser which cuts the thing. We drop it into the bladder, morselate it and remove it. We call it holmium laser enucleation of prostate. That's right.
It's laser. It's not like gunshots, right?
It's a continuous. It's like a welding machine. So you're working with a fiber and you're
like,
cutting.
You know those bank robbers who
exactly
cut
that's
the
what
glass.
I meant. Exactly.
So it's not a pew. It's a key. Okay.
Continuous. It's cool. A continuous energy.
Cool. Nice, fun way to begin this podcast. I've not asked you, how are you? Usually I begin with like, how are you? And that's a slow conversation.
No, I'm absolutely fine. How do you find me?
Having fun talking about burning urethras to a YouTuber?
Of course, why not?
Okay.
It's part of my job.
Yeah. No, it's a part of our job to get these life experiences. I'm enjoying the heck out of this conversation.
Yes.
I think in that last conversation, there was a point where I felt a little uncomfortable at the start when you were talking about the pain related to penises.
Mm-hmm.
But in this one, now I'm used to it. Now, it's okay. We can talk about
burning. Become a urologist now. Urologist by induction.
Burning urethras with lasers.
That's right.
No, but it's cool. Mm-hmm. I find the world of surgery very fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
since I've started talking to surgeons, you know, I've realized that the human body can be manipulated in so many ways if you're doing it carefully.
That's right.
And so if you're being inventive, right?
So if you have an energy in your hand, it's a huge responsibility. So the faster and more effective the energy, more is the responsibility. Because lasers are firing, so you have to be very careful on what you're doing. So obviously, it needs training, it needs concentration, it needs everything. So when I'm doing a laser prostatectomy, nobody talks to me about anything else.
Because you have to focus that.
Focused. That's how it should be. Because you have one chance with this patient. He has to go out and he has to come out and tell you when he comes back that, look, doc, this is a bottle of wine. I'm so happy passing urine. Which certain patients will tell me that, look, I was competing with my grandson. And I told him, now, look, I can pass faster than you. It's a real story. So many of them will come and tell me, and they give me a bottle of wine and tell me, look, you've done a wonderful job. I'm young again. Because they measure their youth by the ability to pass urine.
Oh, damn.
Because passing urine at that age should be pleasurable. If it is pain, then obviously they are waking up 5 times at night, sitting in the washroom for 5 minutes for urine to start. Their wives are getting worried in the bed whether this guy has got a stroke or something. Why is he not coming out? You know, it's a real issue. The wife is standing at the door of the washroom because she feels that this old man, will he come out or not? What has gone wrong with him? And he keeps telling, stay there. I'm fine. I'm just trying to pass urine.
There's so many unforeseen things in life, right? Like, this is not stuff you think about when you're 30 years old also. One day I'm going to have problems passing urine because of an enlarged prostate. But you just got to be ready. You know what a lot of guys in their 20s think about though? Penis enlargement, which is apparently a real thing. I didn't even know that it's an actual surgery. I thought it's like just a bad website ad. You know, that size increase karo and all that, but apparently it's a real surgery. In this era of plastic surgeries, is this a plastic surgery?
It is. Anything that is actually remodeling is a plastic surgery.
Do you do these?
I don't do it. There are certain plastic surgeons who would do it. I don't do it. And, you know, I will tell you one thing as a surgeon, sure, that when I operate upon an organ and I give it back to you, it will be never as natural as it was born.
So true.
So the whether you talk of sensation or you talk of texture or would you talk of whatever. Penis being an organ of sensation primarily, especially playing with it, will certainly alter a lot of things. It may give or enhance pleasure of the partner. By way of somebody looking at the penis and saying, well, now that you have got a good size, but who is gaining pleasure out of it? The partner. Whereas you may have some numb areas or altered sensations in your penis.
That's the price you pay for enlarging your penis.
That's right.
Do you know the surgical procedure? Like what they actually...
Yeah, they are stretching it. Slowly stretching it.
How?
And then adding. Mark certain things and they will put a traction on it. So it is like slow stretch.
Like a rubber band.
That's right.
But they leave the rubber band kind of non-elastic.
Yes. And they keep adding some tissue to it.
What is the tissue?
Normally fat. We call it fat transplant. So they take it from somewhere and put it there. That increases the girth.
Must burger khao baad mein waagi sa.
Shape the banana, but how will you give it the function? If you keep having burgers, you get your testosterone down to your boots.
Yeah.
And then you can't get it up.
Yeah. So basically, they do a fat injection in your penis after stretching it a little bit.
Yeah.
But my point is, then both your flaccid and your erect penis will be bigger?
Yes. Because, you know, eventually the bulk is formed by the fat.
Really?
You know, no. But if you have added fat and if it stays there, the bulk is anyway formed.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
In normal penis, there's no fat.
That's what I'm... Okay.
In normal penis, there's no fat.
You know, but after this surgery, how would your erect penis look different? It would just be massier?
Both ways, lengthwise and girthwise.
It's just a bigger monster, yeah. Super Saiyan penis.
No. You cannot have too much of an enlargement, so don't expect too much.
How much in percentage?
Maybe 10-15%, not more.
Which might be enough for guys who feel insecurity.
That's
about.
Right. More than that, there are release phenomena. So there's a mons pubis, which has fat. A lot of boys who have low or borderline testosterone would have a lot of fat on the mons pubis like a woman.
What is mons pubis?
Mons pubis is the mountain on the pubic bone, the lower abdomen over the pubic bone. So it gives a mound kind of a thing. And the penis gets buried in it. So all you need to do is liposuction in that fat area. And you suddenly see that the penis, which was actually buried, a part of it was buried, becomes visible. Okay.
Got it.
So that gets gaining a length or something like that.
Guys
so,
who are a little overweight,
yeah,
that area would have a lot of fat deposits.
That's right. So part of it is buried inside.
It actually affects performance if that area has a lot of fat?
No, it doesn't affect performance.
It's just a visual thing.
That's right.
So for self-confidence, guys, get it done. Damn.
And releasing certain ligaments, which are tying it to the bone. So you can just make some cut and relax those ligaments so that it releases a little more.
But it's still just a 10-15% increase in size.
No, that is a different technique. We are talking two different techniques here. Liposuction of the fat on the pubic bone and releasing of the ligaments. They are two different. These are two different. And elongation and putting fat into the penis is different. So elongation per se, the actual elongation, you can't have more than 10-15%.
Understood. What if you do all three?
Yeah, that's what people are doing.
What? They do all three?
They do.
And therefore,
it's a plastic surgery job. Basically, it's a plastic surgeon's domain.
So in one operation, they'll do all three?
No, they will do it in stages, maybe.
How do you think the patients feel after it? Happy?
They are committed to feel happy. The first thing is that I will tell my patient that if something I have to do, I will tell him that, look, the normal sensations may not be there. The normal texture may not be there. Are you accepting it? He says yes. So he's committed to it that he is going to like whatever I do.
So texture will not be there, means?
So there's a texture to the skin, no? Right. So if I put some fat or I do some surgery, there's scars up there. Scar is firm. This is soft.
So it'll be like a water balloon?
No, not water. It will be firmer.
Firmer?
Yes. So it is not like soft. It's supposed to be soft. If there is a scar, suppose you have an injury, like you have a scar there. That scar.
So it's pointing towards my hand. For the audio listeners, go on.
So that has a different texture than the normal skin.
As in, you're changing something physiologically about yourself in order to just take care of that one insecurity you're feeling.
Yes, right.
I have more questions related to this. You spoke about changes in the sensation. I would also assume if the texture is different, it's changing for the partner's sensation as well.
No.
Change for the partner.
For partner, it's okay. If it is firm, it is firm.
Okay. Like how that's the argument they make about how lots of guys like condom-less sex and then girls say, no, it doesn't make a difference.
That's right.
I mean, that is subjective, but just generally speaking.
No, there is a difference between the sensation that is being given to the boy and the girl when they use a condom. For a woman, it will not matter. For a man, it will matter.
Generally speaking.
Because, as I said, erections are perpetuated by stimulation of the glands. And if the glands is covered with condom, then that sensation is not there. So then the person has to make an effort to keep himself erect during the process of sexual activity.
Okay. Coming back to this penis enlargement thing, you know, what else can change post that surgery?
Generally, sensations, pain, and sometimes, if the thing goes wrong, then there can be reduction in girth.
Huh?
Or maybe reduction in girth because it becomes ischemic. So, blood supplies, if it goes wrong. So, certain areas will become less in girth, smaller in girth.
Which is actually a big problem.
Which is a problem.
Because they say that girth is the actual key to satisfaction of your partner.
That's right. It is not the length.
Yeah. I saw an Instagram clip. I don't know how true this is. You're a urologist, so you would know much more. But is it true that when men talk about size mattering and when women talk about size mattering, it's two different statements? Like women are actually talking about the girth and men are thinking that it's about the length.
That's right.
That's true.
That's true.
Okay. So like a girthy, like a thick penis is more important than a long penis.
For the woman.
How many guys are truly insecure about the penises?
You see, if you judge yourself, you'll always fail yourself.
So it depends on the guy's
Stop
mind.
Stop judging yourself. Anything.
Okay, I'm going to be very real here. I'm surrounded by a lot of guys who are very driven in their careers and I've grown up with them. So we have all sorts of conversations. No one has ever brought up insecurity about the penis. And I think none of my guy friends at least are actually insecure. Everyone's very secure in themselves.
Yes. Because you're focused on a lot of things. You've achieved a lot of things which others haven't. So that brings you a collateral security.
So you're saying life-based insecurity then will spread to your own size insecurity.
Yes. Mm. If you're insecure, eventually you start finding out things why you're insecure.
Mm.
You won't accept your failures, but you will then point it out at somewhere else.
Mm. Does size matter?
Size, I will tell you, if it is less than 2.5 centimeters, it does matter.
Less than 2.5 centimeters is very small.
Yes.
But you're saying an erect penis less than 2.5?
No, it's actually, I'll tell you, if it can penetrate 2.5 centimeters inside the vagina, because beyond that, there is no sensation in vagina. So vaginal sensation is the first 2.5 centimeters. So if you can traverse that, that's good enough. Now, the problem is, how is your rest of the body? If you have a fat around it, you will not be able to penetrate the 2.5 centimeters. So you will need a larger one. So if you can penetrate beyond 2.5 centimeters of your partner, that's good enough. And again, as we talked, the sexual satisfaction of a woman comes from a lot of things, including this.
Hmm.
In addition.
There is an art to sex.
That's right. The art behind the science.
Which is why Kama Sutra is a thing in the first place.
That's right.
Hmm. Also, a lot of guys honestly don't know the art of sex. Like I've had conversations with a lot of guys about this. I don't think too many guys know.
That's a problem.
I don't even think it's going to change unless someone releases a course on it.
No, there are courses for this. And the best person to teach is the woman.
Hmm. True.
They should explore themselves together.
Yeah, it's called exploring sexuality.
That's right, each other, together.
There's a lot, even as a guy, that you don't know about your own body.
That's right.
We were talking about pleasure points. Guys assume that it's just one.
That's right.
All guys have multiple pleasure points. It's just not discovered.
Yeah.
And your partner needs to discover it for you.
That's right. And the situation and the wiring of your brain and the software at that moment, which is activated, is very important.
What do you mean?
So you are in a romantic mood. If you're not in a romantic mood, none of these things is going to work.
Hmm. Okay. So this conversation is becoming quite romantic and sexual. Therefore, I want to tear it apart and talk to you about what a penis looks like when you cut it open.
Okay.
Just to change the mood.
Yes.
You've had to do some crazy surgeries.
Yes.
The surgery you spoke about in the last episode, is that the craziest surgery you've done?
Yes, that's the craziest that I've done. I've done more. So, for example, for cancer of penis, so in a 28-year-old man, married man, a father of two, had cancer of penis. So I had to remove it completely. We call it radical penectomy.
You have to remove the penis?
Penis, of course. And I removed the lymph nodes also. The lymph nodes were positive. So we gave radiotherapy. Now this man is now 30 and he comes back to me. He has very good balls, scrotum, but he doesn't have a penis. And now he wants to have penis. So I reconstruct a penis for him from his local tissues, put in an implant, and he's a happy man.
You gotta take us through this whole process of a penis removal surgery as well as penis reconstruction. I didn't even know this is possible. You know, I hate bringing this up, but I'm assuming that in road accidents and all, there could be a lot of penis-based
stuff. Yeah, we do that.
Stuff. So let's talk about this situation first. Like, how do you remove it?
Mm-hmm.
How do you construct it again?
So removal of penis is simple. We know that there are two chambers, cylinders, which are coming from each side of the pubic bone. And they are like, you know, like this. They are arching up like Eiffel Tower.
Yeah.
So there are four of them here. Here there are two of them, from one from each side. And they're going, they join together and become the penis. The third one is the central one, which carries the passage of urine called urethra. So if there is a cancer, I need to go right up to the root of penis where these bodies are actually attached to the bone and remove them. And that happens when there is a cancer of penis.
Cancer is caused due to cells multiplying rapidly, but it usually happens in tissues that multiply rapidly, like breast, brain, etc. Does the penis also consist of a tissue that multiplies rapidly?
Any
tissue in your body?
Any tissue can have a cancer.
Muscle, like your bicep?
Yes.
Okay.
We call it sarcoma.
So it's unpredictable. Cancer can happen to anything in your body.
Anybody.
Okay. So you remove the whole penis then?
Yeah, that's right.
That has to feel so difficult psychologically for the patient.
It is.
I cannot imagine what that patient, that poor guy.
Yeah.
I feel like taking his number from you and going and giving him a hug.
Oh, yes. I will.
As a brother. I know. Like in terms of, don't worry, man.
Yeah.
But go on. Like, and I'm sure that's actually your job.
Yeah, that's part of my job. I'm supposed to treat them. I'm supposed to remove the lymph nodes. I'm supposed to remove this penis if it has a cancer. I have to save life. You know, you can fix a problem in a living man. So for that, you need a living man.
Man.
That is important. So you have to do everything. Once you say, okay, 2 years gone, there is no cancer recurrence. That is when we start reconstruction. So reconstructions can be local flaps, as I did in this case, or there is called free flap. So there is a radial artery flap.
One second. You just said something which is not allowing me to absorb everything. Except for 2 years, there's not going to be any penis.
Yes, because we will wait. If there is cancer that comes back, then I cannot reconstruct anything.
For 2 years, that guy is just living with balls.
That's right.
How does he piss?
Because we make a hole in the urethra behind the balls. So he pisses like a woman. He sits and pisses like a woman.
That's psychologically so difficult.
It is, indeed.
How do you even give that guy psychological counseling?
That's part of my job. So if there is a patient who has cancer, it is not the patient who has cancer. It is the family, the whole family, which is like a car accident for the whole family. So the whole family is suffering, the wife, the children, the parents, everybody. Maybe they have no means to support him financially. They will sell their house. They will sell their other belongings. So the whole family is suffering because one person has a disease. So it is never that one person has the disease. So I need to educate the whole family. Educating one person doesn't mean anything. So I spend time with the whole family, talk to the parents, talk to the wife. Wife is the most important person in such a situation. And we discuss that these are the options. This is what I'm going to do. But don't worry, it is treatable. So, as I said, healing comes with positivity. And my job is to create positivity. Once I make a diagnosis, I need to make it very positive for the patient. To such an extent that the patients come back after a year and say, Dr. Saab, we didn't know that we were suffering from cancer. Now we understand that you've done so much. And you sailed us through the thing without our being feeling that there was a cancer. Now we are okay. Now we look back and think, oh my God, what we went through. So that thing has to come from the clinician.
It's probably the biggest joy of your career, right?
That's right.
When you get people past their own suffering.
That's right. My job is to hold their hand and cross them. In that journey of crossing, a 10% or 15% job is the surgical skill. Which is craftsmanship.
The rest of it is brotherhood, especially in this industry.
Lot of it.
Okay. Penis reconstruction.
Yes.
Now you can continue about the surgical angle.
So surgical angle, so reconstruction of penis, we can have either the flaps, the local tissues, which we raise if there are sufficient, and we tubularize it and make a structure. So what I did for that man was we took some plastic mesh and made socks out of it, stitched it to the bone where the penis was used, put in a rigid implant into it, and covered it with a flap of scrotum, which is the area where the testes are, because he has excessive skin there. So wrapped it around and made a penis out of it. The other one is that you take the artery from here and the muscle from here and the fat, take it away, and you then stitch the artery to the artery of the penis and make a flabby kind of a thing, because you normally don't put an implant in the first go. But there is an organ which he can see, which his wife can see. He can pass urine, but certainly having sex with that organ is not a very good idea, because you know you need to give it some time. So after a few months, you can go back and put an implant into it and make it rigid.
So third surgery.
That's right. These things are staged procedures.
And very rare?
Not very rare. In a referral center, in a tertiary care center like mine, they are not very rare.
Because of penis cancer in all cases?
Yeah, mostly penis. Now, you know, there was a time when we had only 1,000 urologists over the country. Now we have almost 5,000 urologists. So there are so many people who are around. So referral becomes less. But then everybody is doing wherever they are.
As in, these problems are more common than one would think.
Yes. Yes.
Damn. You've reconstructed the penis out of fat, muscle, tissue. Now at this point, that person has a organ that looks like a penis and can urinate out of it. But you can't have sex.
Because the sensation is different.
It's not pleasurable.
One, there is no strength. You have not put in an implant as of now. But then you can put an implant later on.
Okay.
The problem with implant is that once you put in an implant and once he starts having sex, then there's always a risk that he's pushing too hard because he doesn't have a sensation.
And then the implant can break?
Implant can perforate and come out. It is like torn socks.
Go on.
If you have a torn sock, it means you're running, your tip of the toe will come out, no? So if you are performing sex, you are not having the sensation to achieve orgasm, you are going on and on. There is a silicone implant inside that tissue, which is anyway an artificial tissue, so it can perforate and come out.
The actual biological core thought here is that you can reconstruct a penis, but perhaps you cannot reconstruct nervous tissue.
That's right. And the nerves that you reconstruct will not have the same pleasurable sensation being carried.
Oh, okay. Can you talk a little bit about this penis implanting? All I know is you get a pump, and this technology has been there for a while, like 50, 60 years. I think it's a button you press.
So I will tell you. So there are three types of implants. So we have semi-rigid. Semi-rigid means there is a plastic PVC rod, literally a rod with a hinge, and you put it into the penis. You open and put one on this side, and close it. And it is erect, so it will remain erect all the time because it's simply a mechanical rod that you're putting in. So to conceal, you can push it back because there's a hinge here, and it is ever ready. So you can have sex anytime.
As in, you just put it up like a door.
Both ways. Because there's a hinge. You can either do this way or you can park it upwards or downwards.
With your hand.
Oh, parking is like, it is just using your, you're trying to conceal an erect organ because it remains erect looking at it all the time.
It's like how in school guys put their penis up into the pant strap.
The pants strap. Exactly.
To hide it. This is the ultra version of it.
Both. You can do both ways.
Oh, you can even go upwards.
Upwards, yes.
God.
The second is a malleable implant. So this is a PVC rod. Then there is a malleable implant where there is a silver wire mesh. And you just have to turn it like this. It stays like this and it stays like this. So whenever you want to do, you can turn it, you can twist. So give it a shape. And so that's a malleable implant. Then comes the inflatable implant. So inflatable implant has a jacket which has fluid in it. and there's a reservoir, and then there is a pump. So they are all connected with tubings. The reservoir is there and there is a pump here. So when you press the pump 3-4 times, it is concealed under the in the scrotum. So it is like a plaything for the woman. So she finds it and pushes it 3 times and there is an erection 3 or 4 times.
And how long does it last?
As long as you want it. Because it's a mechanical thing. You have to get it back. So you have to either just bend it and it will go back, because slowly you have to break the cycle and the fluid goes back to the reservoir. Or there is another button that you push and the fluid goes back to the reservoir.
How difficult is it to do these surgeries?
Oh, that is done very often these days because we do robotic surgery. So when we do robotic surgery for cancer of prostate, then patients become have sexual dysfunction as part of the disease and part of the surgery. And many of them would choose to have a penile implant so that they resume their sexual activity. And we again have to wait for 2 years that there is no sign of cancer. Only then we put in an implant.
How do these guys who get these implants feel psychologically about the implant? They're happy with it?
They're very happy. They're very secure because their woman is not going to go to another man.
That's the core psychology.
That's a huge psychology.
But even in the 60s and 70s?
Doesn't matter. You don't know. Somebody who, at 70, if he's asking for an implant, then you have to understand that he may have more than one partner that is visible.
Fair. So it's all about pleasuring the partner.
Yes.
That's the core thought behind getting an implant.
Because when you put in an implant, you see, the pleasure is derived from the cylinders which are filled with blood. And their blood, and that filling with blood is the one that gives the sensation of pleasure. So when I'm coring through that tissue, making space for a rod or an implant, I'm destroying that tissue which gives pleasure. So do not expect that if I give an implant, the person will have a pleasurable erection.
Okay. What do we even talk about now? These are very heavy thoughts, sir. It's like, is this shaking me up to the realities of being a man in 2024? I mean, it's great that there are all these possibilities out there. But it's like you never think about these things when you think about your own penis also.
Yeah.
Like you never think that, oh, prostate problems, these kind of problems.
The only thing is that if you, the prostate, the benign prostatic enlargement more or less is extremely well treated these days. It is a cancer that one has to be careful. So the symptoms of benign and cancerous prostate are similar. So you must, at the age of 50 onwards, do a PSA once a year. PSA is a blood test called prostate-specific antigen. You keep doing it. If you are first-degree relative, like your father, paternal uncle, elder brother, elder cousin, from the father's side, has had a CA cancer of prostate, then you should start getting it done at the age of 45. Also, if you have a sister, mother who has had cancer of breast, cancer of colon, or if it runs in the families, you may be more prone to getting cancer of prostate. So be careful. So the problem is that whenever there is an old man who has a urinary problem, he calls his GP, he says, okay, start this medicine. So he gets better. But the problem is that this GP, if he forgets to get a PSA done, this man is very happy because some amount of benign prostate has been treated with the medicine, but the cancer keeps growing. And then after 6 months, he goes to him and then he sends it to the urologist, and urologist detects the cancer. Oh, he could have detected it 6 months ago. So if somebody who is above 50 years of age, has urinary symptoms, is being treated, must get a PSA anyway.
What about guys my age? What kind of tests do we need to do?
Enjoy life.
But no blood tests, no?
Nothing.
Okay. Enjoy life. Even if one is unhealthy, like if one is obese and all, would you still...
So if one is obese, if he's having a particular problem, we take lead from there. So we find out what is wrong. Suppose somebody who is an obese, who comes to me, I'll get his blood sugar done, his lipid profile done, I'll get his testosterone, thyroid, everything, I'll get it done. But if somebody is healthy, fighting fit, goes to gym 4 times a week, and is jogging, running, sleeping well, looking well, why should I get a blood test done?
Just for like an update?
Well, it is okay. But I would say that suppose there was a fellow 30 years who is a farmer, you go to his village and he's working 12 hours in the farms, you go and tell him that I want to do certain tests on him, he'll throw you out.
Mm. And his body looks like Bruce Lee's body anyway.
Exactly. That is the problem. Mm. So let us not follow whatever we invent as a medical thing, whether it's a medicine or a test or a modality, we must use it. No. For example, there is a 60-year-old man who goes to executive health checkup and the radiologist says, oh, your prostate is enlarged 60 grams. This is 3 times the normal. So he gets panicked. He comes to me and I ask him, how many times do you wake up at night? He says, none. How many times have you passed urine during the day? Only 3 times. Oh, I've passed 4 times. That means you're fine. Mm. He says, but my prostate is enlarged. Do something. I would say, why should I do something? So I tell him a story. Suppose I go to a village where there are 60-year-old people sitting there and I carry a ultrasound machine and I go and tell them I want to do an ultrasound. They'll say, tu kahan se aa gaya? Where have you come from? What are you doing? Why are you troubling us? Mm. We are having our hookah or smoke or whatever. What are you doing with us? Then I somehow coax them to get an ultrasound done and then I tell them, look, your prostate is enlarged. I want to operate upon it. So they'll throw me out.
Mm.
And here is a man who is an urban male who has gone into an executive health checkup. He gets an ultrasound done. His prostate is enlarged. He sits with me and I take 20 minutes to convince him that you don't require a treatment.
Understood. Because I think it's just the outcomes of having this excess of information in this urban jungle that we live in.
We need to be discreet about what we listen and assimilate.
Mm. And chill out.
Of course. That's the most important thing.
I think even these extreme conversations are just a means of getting to know, but then not absorbing this as tension. Absorbing it as just awareness that these things exist.
No, there will be accidents. There will be hijacks. There will be train accidents, car accidents. So we should know about it. But it doesn't mean that it's going to happen to me.
Right.
Be positive. Do what you can do to prevent. And that's a healthy lifestyle.
The only thing that I would nudge guys my age to be a little careful about, it's very modern problems. We call it STDs. Everyone knows about STDs. Most people that I know practice safe sex also. I'm talking about like urban English-speaking youth. That is the audience of this podcast. But there's also a very, 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 very sharp rise in sexuality in cities. And there's a sharp rise in casual dating and dating apps related culture. Hookup cultures increase a lot. I have a few friends who've taken up gynecology and they said that their seniors told them that the amount of STDs they've seen increase lately is insane. It's in the last 5-10 years that they've seen this sharp rise and increase in STDs. That's a gynecologist for women. Do you see the same thing for guys? Like STDs have increased way too much?
Yes, we do see that. The problem is that in a young man, testosterone, when you have a high testosterone, it takes away your maturity. So at the edge of the moment, at the spur of the moment, people will make mistakes because that is how testosterone is meant to be.
Impulsive.
Mm. And sexual exposure is something that they would think the least of an STD when they have an opportunity to be exposed.
Wow. Where are they getting STDs from?
Obviously, they're getting it from their partners.
It's from people just like them in terms of social strata, or is it prostitution also?
It can be anything. As you rightly mentioned, that casual hookups and dating apps, they're not prostitution. They are promiscuity.
People are looking for sex. Both men and women are looking for sex.
Promiscuity, sexual, multiple sexual partners. So it is a chain. If you have 2 people and you're having, you do not have a third partner, you are unlikely to have sexually transmitted disease. But if one of you is promiscuous, then the chain starts. And then you can give it to another person, and then it goes out of the family, it goes to another person, another family, another person, another family. So that is how it geometrical progression happens.
You know, when people think of STDs, I think the core STD lots of people think of is HIV, like AIDS. And then there's like a layer of syphilis, gonorrhea, herpes. These are the terms that come up a lot in conversation if you're ever talking about STDs to your friends. Which of these three is non-curable? I think it's herpes, right?
No, you see, if it is a virus, it is usually not treatable.
As in, it'll always be in your body.
That's right. So what you missed out was hepatitis C virus.
Right.
Also hepatitis B, but largely hepatitis C. So in communities where there is sexual promiscuity, there are certain communities, certain countries, HCV, hepatitis C virus, is rampant because it is transmitted sexually. And HIV is a virus. So it will remain. It can be subdued with medication, both of these viruses. But then, yes, it remains. And there is always a chance that it resurfaces enough to cause transmission. Because the biggest worry of these people, when they come to me, the man comes to me and says, I love my wife very much, but do you think I'm going to give it to her? Or once you treat me, can I go back to her? Because I don't want her to be infected. Now, that question is, the problem is that you have mixture of sexually transmitted diseases. It is never one. So suppose he's gone to a prostitute, then she may be carrying four organisms, five organisms, out of which three have manifested, two have remained latent, and there is no way that you've actually treated all of them.
Do you think there's many people carrying STDs that don't even know that they have an STD?
Women especially. Because for them, it's a way of life. If they have a burning while passing urine, or they have an itchy vagina, they think it's a way of life because their elder sister or somebody in the family or somebody in the neighborhood also has that. Unless they go to a gynecologist who takes pains to look at the cervix, takes some samples, the STD may never be diagnosed. So the diagnosis has to be done. And most important is, of course, beyond this prevention, the person needs to be aware that if he has had an exposure, he must get himself checked. Because that's the least he can do after that. Because by then the testosterone surge has come down and the spur of the moment has gone. Now you have time to think yourself. You should get yourself examined. Go to the specialist, run the tests, see what you can do about it.
What are the common ones you see in India?
We see a lot of herpes simplex virus. Herpes simplex virus is one of the commonest these days. And we also see gonorrhea. Syphilis, we don't see, at least doesn't come to urologists as much. Maybe it is going to the dermatologist because it is the secondary syphilis and the tertiary syphilis that comes over.
What is that? What is primary, secondary, tertiary?
So primary syphilis is a lesion on, it's a affection of the glans penis. There's this thing that comes up and it's like a sore which heals on its own.
Like a pimple?
That's right. No, it breaks down, forms an ulcer or something.
Okay.
That guy forgets it, but then it resurfaces after a few years as secondary syphilis. So there are certain inflammatory nodules all over the body. It can happen anywhere. We call it gamma. But then these things are rare as compared to what they were 50 years ago. Because the tertiary and syphilis, secondary syphilis, they don't come to a urologist, then I am not in a good position to answer that question. But certainly I see a lot of gonorrhea.
How does it look?
The syphilis.
Gonorrhea.
Gonorrhea. Gonorrhea looks like there is a painful urination. The person presents with painful and pus coming out of the urethra. It's really pus, like if you have seen somebody has a pimple which cracks and there is pus exuding. So there's pus coming from the urethra. So it is staining the undergarment. It is all over the glans penis, all over the foreskin, all over the undergarments. So it's staining. So when the person comes to me, he tells me that he has intense pain when he passes urine. He has burning and he has these things coming out. So I just examine and I take a sample of this pus, send it to the lab, make a slide. So they do a test called Gram stain on the slide. With the swab, the sample that I send, they do a culture. And the report comes in 2 to 3 days. But my clinical sense says, yes, this is it. So I treat him with broad spectrum antibiotics, which are supposed to hit gonococcal and additional microbes, which might be there. As I said, most of them are mixed infections.
But it goes away?
A lot of it goes away, yes. If you're giving a good dose, the point is they should take a good dose, complete dose.
If you've had, say, gonorrhea once, it stays in your body forever?
Gonorrhea normally doesn't stay. It's a bacterium which is killed. Once it is killed, it is killed. But the only thing is that if somebody has had a gonorrhea in the urethra and it has caused an ulcer there or a wound there, it heals with scarring. And that is called stricture of urethra. So stricture means there's a pipe and there's a constriction because there's a scar here and then there's a pipe there. So the pipe has been constricted. Mm. So there's a stricture in that area. So the person starts passing urine, it comes up to here and can't pass beyond.
Painful.
Painful and poor stream. It just can't move. And frequency, recurrent infections, unrelated, non-gonococcal infections, and requires a lot of, maybe it requires a reconstruction for the urethra because this pipe is damaged totally, scarred. So you need to do something to create a passage for this.
And third one, herpes.
Herpes is something which doesn't present with pus. It presents with burning sensation. And there may be no signs of infection, but inflammation sometimes. And then there can be ulcers, which are intensely painful. More than what you can see. Sometimes you can't see. You have to really make an effort to see the ulcer, but it is still causing so much of pain. So herpes simplex virus causes a lot of pain and burning, apart from a small ulcer, which it can cause, or multiple small pimples that it can cause.
Also infinite. Like it doesn't die.
The problem with herpes viruses is that you can give medication. They will get subdued. But herpes simplex virus doesn't leave body as easily as bacteria can be.
And you will end up giving it to your partner if you get it.
Yes, that's it. So in certain countries, especially the Middle East, they do a test for herpes simplex virus if they are taking manpower from here to there. So one of the tests that you need to do is in IgG immunoglobulin for herpes simplex virus. Because if you have had an exposure to HSV, herpes simplex virus, it shows up in the blood even if you don't have an infection today. And if that is positive, you don't get a job in Middle East countries, countries. Because they know that you are carrying this virus, you could go and give to their women.
I think it's a very smart move. That's on right. Behalf of those governments.
That's right.
Coming back to India, you see a lot of spread of these.
Yes.
How much has it increased in percentage?
Well, we've been seeing it quite often these days. I see at least 2-3 a week.
2-3 a week?
Because I'm actually doing a lot of other things.
Surgeries.
I'm doing cancers, I'm doing a lot of andrology, right. I'm doing a lot of interstitial cystitis, bladder pain, prostate, everything I'm doing. But I still get to see 2-3 patients a week.
What's the commonality in all these patients?
Commonality is in terms of one that, these patients are usually not very well-read. So they come from a median, middle-class community. They are not well-to-do community.
This is a very key conversation.
This is important. So middle-class community, and if you ask their women, they would say burning wo to pata nahi kitne saalon se ho rahi hai. So we don't know who's the source, the man or the woman.
Hmm. It's probably some old boyfriend.
No, whoever. Who has given. Whatever. So, but then it is in high society, I don't see as much herpes actually.
Hmm. What do you think of lube? Does it have bad effects? Lubricant?
So lubes are, there are two, three types of lubricants. One is the one which is an inert lubricant like a KY jelly. And it is used to facilitate sexual activity in usually newly marrieds because the vagina is not spacious, the woman is not relaxing enough. And every time the man is trying to get in, he doesn't know exactly in what angle, what direction he has to go. So he hits, causes pain, and the woman squeezes it and makes it more difficult for the man to enter. So that is one kind of lubricant. The other kind of lubricants are one for the male, which is for premature ejaculation.
Which numbs it.
The third one is the tingling, which increases the pleasure. So you put that lubricant inside or on the penis, and it releases a kind of chemical which causes tingling sensation. So it adds on to the pleasure of sex.
I don't know. I just don't buy the idea of mixing chemicals with this.
No, but then these are available.
Are they safe to use?
Well, I'm not an authority, but I think because they are available, our government must have seen some regulations to make them safe.
Okay. Let's twist the conversation fully now. And I want to ask you a question. Why does it hurt so much when you're whacked in the balls?
Yes. So it is because those structures are totally unprotected. For example, if I punch on your face, you have a layer of fat, which causes a compression and reduces the impact.
Like a cushion. Hmm.
Wherever you have a fat, every damn place except balls.
Yeah, okay.
And they are hanging.
Hmm.
The second thing is they are hanging. So when you are hit there, they're totally unprotected and they are pulled. So there is a pull. Even if somebody pulls the balls, it causes pain.
Yeah.
Even if it is not being hit, even if there is not too much of a trauma, it is just gentle pulling will cause pain.
But what causes that pain that shoots up to your stomach?
Because testes are born with the kidneys. The blood supply and the nerve supply of the kidney, of the testes, is the same as that of the kidneys. And kidneys are in the middle of the upper part of the stomach. So the place where the thorax or the chest cavity and the abdomen meet, that is called diaphragm. So kidneys are located just below the diaphragm, and the blood supply of the testes also come from the same part of the artery. So the nerves also go there, the lymph also goes there. So if you are hit in the testes, your pain is felt in the abdomen.
Yeah, you know the worst thing about getting hit in the balls, and all boys have been hit in the balls at some point in their life. The worst thing is that it's explosive pain when it happens, and then it's lingering pain for like 10, 15 minutes in your stomach after.
Yeah.
It's one of the weirdest forms of pain you'll ever feel. So it's effectively that whole nervous pathway is getting a pain signal.
Yes. Yes.
Do you get a lot of ball-related problems? Because we do. So much about penis, but very little about ball.
Something like torsion of testes, which happens. Torsion. So this happens in young men where, you know, even if they are sitting or they are not having any sexual thoughts, their testes are like this that they can just twist. So normally testes should not be able to twist because there is a system there. But then there are developmental variations. We call them bell clapper deformity. So unless the testes rotates 270 degrees, 2.5 times. Unless it rotates 2.5 times, its blood supply doesn't get cut. But then if it goes up to 2.5 times, then the testes dies off because of lack of blood supply.
Oh, God. Oh.
And this happens suddenly. So person has a pain while he's in sleep or he's sitting or doing anything, and he suddenly has a pain. And if the person doesn't reach a urologist within 6 hours, and derotate the testes dies.
And then kachak. You snip it off. And you're just left with one ball.
No, then what I do is I put a plastic ball inside so that at least the partner shouldn't understand. She may not keep telling him that, look, I've got a defective piece or a suboptimal piece.
Okay, there's one final topic today that I want to address, which is circumcision, which is also a religious act in the world. But there's an ongoing internet debate right now about how if you circumcise anyone, you're removing a lot of nerve endings. And therefore, the amount of pleasure they feel during sex is lesser than someone who is uncircumcised. And therefore, they can last longer in bed because they're not gaining as much pleasure from the sex. Now, there's also another urban legend that being circumcised is actually much better to prevent STDs as well as a much more hygienic thing to do. And then there's a whole other debate about uncircumcised penis cleanliness. Not too many guys even know how to clean like their penis and all that. So all these things. How important is the foreskin?
So foreskin, nature has given foreskin for a reason. And the reason is that glans penis is the most sensitive part of the body.
What is glans penis?
The head of the penis is called technically the glans. This, the most sensitive part of the human body is that glans. Mm. Like in women, it is clitoris.
Got it.
So foreskin protects it.
Sure.
It's a protective thing. But it has been found that in communities where the foreskin is removed at birth, or maybe within the first year of life, it reduces the chances of cancer of penis. More so in communities where it is removed immediately after birth. So they say perhaps there could be some microorganisms which are sitting in the foreskin, that bag and that pouch, and they can incite a cancerous reaction to the glands. So that is one scientific thing that's undebated. Regarding the second thing that you said was absolutely right, because it reduces the sensitivity of the glands. They last longer because the cycle is slow to reach orgasm. It takes longer to reach it. The threshold is raised, basically.
Basically, you're not feeling as much pleasure as your uncircumcised brethren.
Threshold is raised.
It takes longer to come.
That's right.
Okay.
The third is regarding hygiene. I think it is a matter of culture. And those communities who have foreskin, traditionally, they are taught by their parents how to keep it clean, traditionally. And it is not difficult to clean once rituals are followed, whatever is taught. So whether circumcision is better or not depends upon what you want in life. Eventually, the nature has given you a foreskin to cover the most sensitive part of the body to protect it. Suppose there was something which came cutting. So foreskin will get cut and protect your glands.
Hmm.
So it is a protective covering which nature has given. So has a reason nature has given that. And that's it. But yes, certainly in communities where it is done in the very early life, there is a reduction in cancer of penis.
The online internet debate is that should you even be getting circumcised? I think it's a very America debate because in America, I believe they circumcise most babies, but no one knows why. There's not a religious reason for it. It's just it's a trend that they circumcise babies.
In Muslims and in Jews, there's a trend.
I mean, there it's religious.
There's a religion. But even in Christians, certain communities would go for circumcision, but not all. But whatever it is, I think, beyond religious reason, which one is, you know, within their rights to choose. Beyond religious reasons, I think there's no reason to do a circumcision.
A tight foreskin?
Yes, if there's a problem, as I said, if there is a problem, then it is called phimosis.
Phimosis.
P-H-I, phimosis. And that is when you cannot open, when you cannot clean it, then it certainly needs a circumcision. If there's a borderline phimosis where you can pull it back, but there is a situation when you have an erection, you pull it back, you cannot pull it, come get it back in position. So that is called paraphimosis. So the skin goes back, doesn't come forward, gets stuck there, gets swollen, red, and gets broken down, forms an ulcer, bleeding, whatever, gal jati hai, it gets rotten. So that is paraphimosis, and it is a surgical emergency, and it's a very simple thing to be treated. You can just remove with certain, under local anesthesia, you can reduce the paraphimosis. You can take away all the fluid that is collected in the foreskin. Most of these things happen when the person is, starting a sexual activity, sexual life.
Like you realize that your foreskin is tight after you begin
because you have had sex, and suddenly you realize that the skin is not coming back, and you are stuck in a place where there's no medical help. So that is what I will say with caution, that people who think their foreskins are tight must get evaluated by a urologist for a preemptive circumcision.
I think even this tight foreskin problem, phimosis, is pretty common compared to what most people think. Because I remember having this conversation with a lot of my bros in school. We used to have a column in Mumbai Mirror called Ask the Sexpert with Dr. Mahinder Vatsa. And that's where a lot of people got to know things about reproduction, or your own organs, and sex in general. And he spoke about how the skin has to be pulled back. And I had a friend who came up to me and said that, listen, does yours get pulled back? Because mine doesn't get pulled back. And that's how a lot of guys figure that, okay, there's actually probably a tight foreskin problem. Then they go to a urologist for the first time.
So I'll tell you, the pediatricians are supposed to tell the and check this. Every time the male child goes for immunization and other things, the pediatrician is supposed to see and ask the mother whether she's cleaning it properly, opening it up. If she's not opening it up, there is an issue. So he sends them to a surgeon. A pediatric surgeon is supposed to see and either do a circumcision or advise what is to be done, how it can be opened and kept open, right, so that it can remain openable and cleanable.
So the bottom line here is there's no correct answer in terms of being circumcised and uncircumcised.
That's right.
Like it's a personal choice.
That's right. Absolutely. Oh. But there are certain medical conditions which actually need circumcision. As I said, in diabetic elderly men, where there could be infections, and there the foreskin becomes a seat of infection, and we need to remove the foreskin and do circumcision.
Okay. I'm assuming that when you circumcise someone at that age, the glands are probably very sensitive, right?
No, it is the other way around. If there is a 20-year-old boy who has never had an opened glands, and if you do a circumcision on him, his glands is going to be very sensitive.
How do you desensitize it?
There's no way.
Hmm.
So what we do is we put a thick ointment over it, so that it forms a film. So we teach the patient and the patient actually, because he's a boy, that you keep putting the ointment over it. Do not try to clean it. So that when you put the ointment next time, the previous ointment would have formed a film and would reduce the sensitivity. And it takes almost 3-4 days for the sensitivity to go.
So for those 3-4 days, you'll be very tender.
It is.
And then it just becomes normal after a point.
It becomes normal, absolutely.
Gotcha. This was a far from normal podcast, but a very important podcast. Sir, fun talking to Dr. Taneja. I hope you had fun as well, sir.
Oh, yes, of course.
Thank you. Appreciate you, sir. We'll be linking all your handles down below. And I just hope you had fun in the conversation.
Oh, yes, I did.
Okay. Awesome. We'll be seeing you again. Yeah. And we'll have a deeper, longer conversation. No pun intended, the next time.
Yes. Very nice. Thank you very much, Ranveer, for getting me here. And through your channel, I think it should be fruitful for the people who have actually gone through this podcast, because there are things which seem very obvious but are still not clear to the general public and need to be educated.
100%. Thank you, sir. We'll be seeing you very, very soon. Thank you.
Thank you, Ranveer.
That was part two of our epic conversation with Dr. RT. On TRS. Make sure you check out all the other medical and health conversations that we've been releasing on TRS on both the English and the Hindi podcasts. So much biological information, so many perspectives on health, so many fun, elaborate, free-flowing conversations. We'll link the playlist down below. Make sure you keep supporting TRS, Ranveer and the team. We'll be back very, very soon. Keep it long, keep it hard, keep it healthy, baby.